This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome to the Science and Tech Exploring Ethics Forum. I'm Dr. George Hightower, the director of the Science and Tech Ethics Center. I want to thank you all for joining us. I also want to thank Dr. Dorothy Tamayo-Murillo and Caitlin Liu and the rest of the executive board for helping to organize this event. Today we're a bit more structured, but for good reason. I'm really fortunate that we can welcome Dr. Aaron Kovitz to join us today. Our goal in hosting these events is to nourish leadership and understanding of the ethical dimensions that shape medicine, technology, and scientific research. Our topic today will be cervical cancer prevention, innovation, and community-based research. Without further ado, I'd like to go ahead and welcome Dr. Kovitz.
So good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, George, so much for providing me this opportunity to talk about the importance of community engagement in research to develop new technologies or to address variability in health outcomes. As George mentioned, my name is Aaron Kovitz. I'm a professor of medicine and public health sciences, obstetrics and gynecology, marine biology and ecology at the University of Miami. I hold multiple leadership roles at the institution. I'm the institution's inaugural chief health equity officer and vice president for health equity. I serve as the associate director for community outreach and engagement at our University Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. And I also am the multiple PI and co-director of our university's Clinical Translational and Science Institute. In all of those roles, community is really central to everything that I do. I'm going to tell you a little bit about why, and then maybe when we open it up to questions, I can address some of your interest around community engagement in translational research. So many years ago, almost two decades ago, when I was recruited to the University of Miami School of Medicine, I was recruited by the Cancer Center Director to develop a program in cancer disparities. Despite being a Miami native, I knew very little about how cancer risk and outcome was geographically represented across the Miami metropolitan area. I lived away a very long time pursuing my academic training. And so as a way to better appreciate the local landscape of disease and to understand whether the burden was disproportionately affecting certain population groups that comprise South Florida, I conducted a mapping exercise to help me appreciate if there was any variability in cervical cancer incidence or mortality throughout Miami. And the reason I was focused on cervical cancer is because I think that this is an objective marker of health disparity. When women have equitable access to the formal healthcare system, they generally don't develop or die of cervical cancer. And my mapping exercise actually revealed that there was an area in Miami where there was four times higher incidence of cervical cancer than had been reported for the rest of the state of Florida, and really rivaled what had been observed in the developing world, namely the Caribbean and Latin America. I actually thought that what my map found was a function of statistical artifact. Miami zoning is kind of funny, and so I assumed that what I was seeing on the map was a function of too few women living in an area that was primarily swampland. But the beautiful thing about maps is that they give you the ability to focus in on cross streets. So I did that, and I got in my car and drove, and very quickly realized the limitations of my assumption, because I found myself in an ethnic enclave known as Little Haiti, which is the largest enclave of Haitian settlement anywhere in North America. Actually, it's probably the largest enclave of Haitian settlement anywhere in the world outside of Haiti. The only reason that I knew that this was Little Haiti was because there was a predominance of signs in a language other than English or Spanish, which are the two predominant languages spoken in Miami. And so, you know, I wasn't sure what to do. So went back to the university and tried to engage some of my senior leaders and colleagues in conversation about whether there had been research at the university with the Little Haiti community and what the outcome had been. And my senior colleagues tried to dissuade me from pursuing further research with the Haitian diaspora community. And I didn't really understand what their hesitance was. I believe in retrospect that they were really focused on my tenure ability and thought that I was opening like a so-called can of worms, where if I tried to pursue this line of inquiry within this particular community, that it might derail my focus in such a way that I wouldn't secure significant grant dollars or publish peer-reviewed manuscripts that would lead to like my ultimate academic success. I guess luck would have it that I was naive and egotistical enough to not care. And so went back into the Little Haiti community to try to initiate conversation with community leaders around whether they perceive cervical cancer to be an issue. And if yes, like where they thought research might have a role in trying to both understand the issue and ultimately address it. Because today's lecture is not really focused on community-based participatory research, I don't want to go into all of the details and all of the lessons learned that I garnered from my initial foray into Little Haiti. But if I fast forward, what I can tell you is that I ultimately built with key community stakeholders a campus community partnership that we call Patne en Acción, which brought academic investigators such as myself to work collaboratively with key community leaders from Little Haiti to frame research that was reflective of our mutual interest and shared commitment to ensuring that Haitian women didn't continue to develop and die of a disease that was preventable. You know, so my work with the Haitian community falls under a translational methodology called community-based participatory research, or CBPR. CBPR has been popularized within medicine and public health for at least the two decades, though arguably like it dates back to 30 to 40 years ago in the disciplines of anthropology and sociology, where these disciplines readily appreciated the necessity of bringing community stakeholders whose lives the research was intended to change to the table to help inform the conceptualization of the idea and ultimately the implementation of the research. CBPR really posits that community stakeholders should be engaged throughout the entire continuum of research, from the conceptualization of the idea to the dissemination of findings, and in so doing, bridge the gap between researcher and research, helping address power differentials that often play out between community members and academics, and to ensure that there was an equal commitment to understanding why there was such an observed higher burden of cervical cancer within Little Haiti. So this is kind of where we get to both the ethics and the technology. So Little Haiti is a federally designated medically underserved area, which means there's a shortage of primary care providers available to meet the preventive care needs of the community. So women in Little Haiti had no options or very few options in the neighborhood in which to participate in cervical cancer screening. So my assumption, as somebody who was totally trying to approach this problem from a traditional Western public health and medicine orientation, was that we should build a clinic where women would have that access. And I'm extraordinarily grateful to my community partners who helped me appreciate that simply building a clinic wouldn't overcome the multi-level barriers that Haitian women were facing in relation to cervical cancer screening, many of which were completely independent from the access barrier in and of itself. And so what I came to learn over time was that, one, that in Little Haiti, there was this pluralistic understanding of health and disease promotion that tended to blend lay understandings of disease etiology, something like humoral theory, which is really popular in the Caribbean and speaks the need to achieve balance in bodily humors to maintain health. That lay understanding would get blended with Western medicine. And so it wouldn't always elicit a straightforward response if you were to ask somebody in Little Haiti if they practice disease prevention, because what I was thinking was, you know, they were getting routine cervical cancer screening, and what they were thinking was that they were drinking teas that helped achieve that balance that they felt was essential in order to reduce the risk of disease onset and progression. And so that dissonance was really important for me to understand. It was also important for me to appreciate that there was pretty significant cancer fatalism within the Haitian diaspora community. Women's perception of cervical cancer was something that you inherently died from. There isn't actually a word in Creole for cervix. It kind of translates to colmatrice, which means sort of the end of the womb, which anatomically we know is where the cervix is. But it's hard to educate about the importance of early detection for a disease for which there isn't a word within the language of preference within the community that you're serving to attach significance of that disease to. You know, what ultimately drove the development or the testing of technology was the candid admission by a number of community members, those active in the community advisory group, as well as those who were participating in some of our preliminary data collection, that there was significant adversity to a pap smear because women really didn't like a speculum. And I don't think there's anybody who has a cervix who thinks a speculum exam is comfortable. But what I was coming to appreciate at the time in Little Haiti was that the discomfort was much more nuanced than physical pain. And what women would share is that they felt that the speculum changed the tone or rigidity of their vaginas in such a way that they were no longer sexually desirable to their male partners on whom they were economically dependent. And this made it very clear to me that opening a clinic wasn't going to meet the need, that the need was going to have to be a more community competent, culturally sensitive strategy for disease prevention that really resonated with this particular community's priorities and perspectives on cervical cancer risk reduction. So ultimately, what we ended up doing with lots of lit searches and pressure from community partners to come up with a strategy that was as efficacious as a speculum-based exam, but different, was we were among the first to ever test self-sampling for human papillomavirus in a community setting. And you know, this work, if you all know anything about self-sampling for human papillomavirus, is kind of at the end of its translational arc. So after my studies, and we did many, many NIH-funded studies, there have been other studies. And recently, the FDA just approved self-sampling for HPV in a clinical setting. And then there are many institutions, mine being one of them, that are participating in something called the Last Mile Trial, which is an effort by the National Cancer Institute to secure the final data points that the FDA has said are necessary for self-sampling for HPV to be available in non-clinical settings where arguably the uptake might be greatest and might really resonate with our observations in Little Haiti, which is that if you gave women a strategy for screening that resonated with their priorities for public health promotion, that they would do it, and that you could ultimately then link them to the formal healthcare system in the event that they had an abnormality. So in this case, high-risk HPV. And so, you know, I share this story because I think it really highlights some key aspects that are central to this dialogue, right? So one, the importance of having community at the table when you're doing research that ultimately aims to change that community, whether it be disease prognosis or availability of care, it's ultimately really essential, and one might argue ethical, to ensure that the voices of those individuals are at the table in framing the solutions that get implemented to ensure that the appropriate resources or the resources are being appropriately spent. So that's one. Two, I think that we often fail to recognize that many of the solutions that we look to nominate for persistent public health problems may actually exist in the very communities that we intend to serve. And so in this case, the notion of self-sampling or another approach to cervical cancer screening was actually nominated by the community. My community partners pushed hard for us to think about something other than a traditional provider collected speculum exam or provider performed speculum exam, because they knew that even among women who had access, that uptake would be low, given some of the cultural or sociocultural beliefs and constraints that I previously referenced. And so I have come to learn across my career that when you give community voice and you honor the viability of that voice in framing the focus and scope of science, that the science not only has greater translational potential, but that it ultimately ensures that the innovation that's being developed can be effectively delivered to the communities that it's intended to serve. And so with that, maybe I can just open it up to questions, and I appreciate everybody's time.
Great. Thank you. That's such a great start. I'm so appreciative of you taking the time to spend with us. I'm going to keep an eye on the webinar chat to see questions that are coming in from the audience, but I thought I would start out with one of my own. I was curious, among your first stakeholders from Little Italy, what values did they express for their participation or their work with you to get started?
So that's a great question, George. You know, something that I came to appreciate very early on in Little Haiti was that there was significant skepticism about research, right? And that many people in the community perceived research to be a bit of a dirty word. And I think there are two things that I would attribute that fact to. So one, I think Little Haiti, like many underserved communities, had been victim to like parachute science, where, you know, faculty or trainees would get research dollars to collect data. They would land in the community, acquire all of the information that they needed to fulfill, you know, their grant aims or study priorities, and then leave without ever sharing what they found back with the community. And that's actually a big ethical issue in my perspective. And so, you know, the community has willingly participated in research, but doesn't benefit from the findings, or doesn't benefit from knowing of the findings in such a way that they might be able to intervene on those that are actionable. And that's kind of icky. And I think that we all can probably point to examples of other communities that have been victim to this parachute science, and as a result of that are very disinclined to participate in research. All of us, you know, unwittingly inherit the baggage of the institutions of which we're a part. So even if our intent is to like bring community members to the table to share the data and to help them think through how to act on findings, we carry with us, by virtue of our institutional identity, everything that's come before us. And so that's something that's really tricky. The other thing was that during the early days of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, Haitian ancestry was actually erroneously labeled as a risk factor for transmission by the Centers for Disease Control. And that proclamation, if you will, leveraged like really good epidemiologic data that actually came from the University of Miami, demonstrating that there was an increased burden of this infection in the Haitian American community that was living in South Florida. And the research itself wasn't bad, but in a time of, I think, tremendous uncertainty, it was manipulated, you know, by the media and politicians and probably regular community members to really legitimize the discrimination of a group of people who were already very much living on the margins. And so when I wanted to do research, that was what I was facing, right? Because the value, the community ethos around research had been overwhelmingly negative, understandably so. And so in order for me to align with community values and to demonstrate that the research that I was proposing would in fact be collaborative and in large part driven by the community, it meant that I had to show up and spend time in and with in the community and with community members to demonstrate my commitment to a shared purpose, even if those things that I was participating in ultimately had nothing to do with the science that I was hoping to accomplish. And so, you know, I think in many communities, we tend, you know, underserved communities, we tend to focus a lot on risk. And I think what I came to appreciate in working with these community leaders was that one of their values was also to give attention to asset and to think about how to maximize assets of the community and the work that we were doing. So as an example, you know, when we were thinking about the best strategy for dissemination of HPV self-sampling, they felt really strongly that we had to leverage these deep rooted communal ties by identifying natural helpers in the community. So those individuals that others would readily turn to for advice and support, and like train them with the ability to identify women within their social networks who are unscreened or underscreened for cervical cancer and have them offer those individuals the chance to self-sample. And I think that was usually important, right? So I think in all the work that I do, it's about finding common ground and figuring out how what you want to accomplish as a researcher or what your priorities are as a human being map onto those of the community in which you hope to work. And through that common ground, developing some rules of engagement that ultimately give value and voice to the community members to ensure that how they feel is represented in the work that moves forward.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And I think one of the other questions that is going to bring up your address with this notion of trust, where I think a lot of us that do work with marginalized or underserved communities have seen it as a struggle at baseline, and maybe going forward, those rules of engagement and that participation is going to kind of be more of a struggle. But I think that those general outlines still apply. Would you agree?
100%. I think they still apply.
I think one of the other things that maps onto that as well is I think one of the things you address, and I just want to put to the forefront, is I think it can often be from the standpoint of scientists or clinicians, this idea of pap smears identify cervical cancer and save lives. So the only thing a patient should be concerned about is if the person doing it can technically do it, right? Otherwise, you should show up and have it done. And I'm curious if you ran into, I know with the discussions that you had within the community, very clearly, right? You gained insight very quickly that this was not the way that they were thinking about it. Did you struggle on the other side with the university in terms of, no, so I'm curious.
Okay, so, you know, so there, when we started, like, I mean, this work was really lucky in that when My Haitian colleague said you need to find a strategy other than a pap smear to reduce the burden of cervical cancer. It just so happened that there had been a number of peer-reviewed publications in the past, like 4 months, that spoke to the effectiveness and efficacy of self-collected samples for detection of human papillomavirus. That's kind of where the work stopped, right? Like it was stuck in the clinic. And, you know, I think one of the largest impediments to translational impact is like this divide between the ivory tower and the community, where innovation ultimately needs to live in order for it to achieve its intended impact. So, you know, it was my K award, which was my career development award, was really trying to figure out like, well, is this acceptable and is it feasible? And by acceptable is like, are women who are going to use this going to find this to be an appropriate strategy? Do they feel like if they've ever had a exam performed by a physician that they like it more, at least they like it the same? Would they recommend it to friends and family? And it was overwhelmingly acceptable. From a feasibility perspective, what we found mirrored what had been in the literature, was that like when women self-collected samples, the cell volume and luminosity, which were necessary to actually perform the HPV assays, were better when they were self-collected. And I think in our sample, and this is going back a really long time now, like only 3% of women didn't collect sufficient cervical cells to be tested for HPV, which was a very small number, and actually was lower than what had been reported in the literature for provider collected specimens. So, you know, had I been maybe trying to do this without the benefit of some of the literature that came before me, I might have met some skepticism, but because I had this scientific evidence that suggests that this strategy was efficacious, I was not meeting pushback. Now, what I will tell you is when we were first starting to do this work, there weren't that many available HPV assays on the market, right? Like this is 20 years ago. So what we were doing was actually testing for HPV just on a regular PCR machine in the pathology lab because it was CLIA certified. But then we were doing HPV genotyping like in gel, which I don't think anyone would use these days, but was the only way that we could begin to appreciate not just the prevalence of HPV, but more importantly, the type distribution of HPV within this particular community.
Helpful. And I think with the gel, people may not appreciate it's very laborious, right? It's very expensive.
And it's also like you're like looking to see like how it like, you know, the DNA is represented in for different types. And a lot of it is kind of conjecture anyway.
Right. Technology's come away.
A long way.
Question that we've gotten from the audience, it's a big topic in of itself. It's about vaccinations in the Haitian community. Specifically, they ask, has the research you've done had any impact or effect on the vaccination rate? I think it's HPV vaccination and kind of how that fits into your work.
So, you know, it's interesting. We did some work early on around the acceptability of HPV vaccination in the Little Haiti community and came to appreciate that there was some real gender difference. So women, parents were very happy to vaccinate their age eligible boys, but at the time there was not actually even approval for than they were their girls. And then we also did some other work because the initial vaccine that came out was just targeting 16 or 18. And we had appreciated from the gel experiments that 16 and 18 were not the most prevalent types of high-risk HPV in the Haitian community. And in fact, when you would look at women who had high-grade intraepithelial lesions, they didn't have 16 or 18 either. And so we had many conversations with Merck around the fact that, you know, there was this community that wasn't obviously captured in the statistic of 70% of cervical cancer cases worldwide are caused by HPV 16 and 18. And then the barrier always became one of cost, right? I mean, HPV is not a required vaccination. depending on your insurance carrier, the coverage for that vaccine could be pretty significant. And so I'm not a vaccination person, so it's not ever been a real focus of my work. And I've not tried to change the vaccination rates. Vaccination rates for HPV in the state of Florida are pretty low, as they are throughout the rest of the state, the country.
Thank
and they've
you
gotten worse since COVID.
Thank you for the insight. I'm going to ask one of my questions, and then it looks like we've got some more questions coming in, so I'm going to give it a little bit more time. I think in response to your last question, touched on this. I think it's so important. Thinking about the timing, both for the commitment, the amount of time, and building those relationships with community and stakeholders, the time for getting the actual collection done, right? The funding. Can you walk us through that? Because you hinted 20 years, right? Do you mind walking us through those parts just to give a sense? I think for a lot of young investigators, that can be quite daunting.
So, I mean, I think when you're trying to get a technology, you know, you're trying to get technology up, like uptake, it's about persistence. And it's about thinking strategically about what you need to do in order to test the technology and to ensure that the uptake meets, if you will, like the requirements for scalability. And so I wrote a lot of grants. I think I was really lucky in this part of my career with that work, because it was like funding beget funding beget funding. So like I got an R21, I got my K, like it just kept coming. And I think it was because our data was like so significant and impressive in demonstrating that self-sampling was in fact a strategy that met the needs and expectations of many women. So I see that there's like a question that says, is it scalable beyond this community? Well, the answer to that is yes. Like we've done multiple clinical trials, as have others, you know, expanding access to HPV self-sampling to other communities of women who, for whatever reason, are disenfranchised from the formal healthcare system, or people with cervixes who feel like a traditional speculum-based exam doesn't meet their needs for cervical cancer prevention. And I think we know that it's scalable on the basis that like it's been approved by the FDA and it's now moving towards approval for, you know, non-clinical settings where uptake can potentially be maximized by those individuals who may interact with a MinuteClinic at their local drugstore or pharmacy, but may not have a regular source of primary gynecologic care. With HPV testing, you don't need endocervical cells, which is one of the benefits of this approach, is that, you know, even HPV in the vagina is sufficient to then high-risk HPV in the vagina is sufficient to then pursue additional diagnostic workup. And, you know, there's, I think, a lot of evidence for now decades that shows that HPV testing is more effective for reducing cervical cancer mortality than a cytology-based exam. And lots of discussion, in fact, about maybe switching the paradigm, certainly for women who are 30 years of age and older, that you would first look at for the presence of high-risk HPV, and then in those women who are positive, either triage to a pap smear, or depending on the place where they live, maybe immediately triage to colpo, so that you could visualize whether there were in fact lesions and whether those lesions needed to be biopsied to inform additional treatment.
Oh, that's great. I'm curious for the question that's scalable, maybe shifting the conversation, maybe the question a little bit to say, when you were there at the beginning, did you think about innovation? We need to do something different. Did you think about scalable? Did you think about those at the same time with the early studies?
So I don't think in the beginning I was thinking about scalability, right? Like I was thinking about solving like a problem that was up close and personal to me, which is that there were a group of women in my community who were developing and dying of a disease that was preventable. And in large part, right, that disparity was a function of underutilization of screening. And so, you know, my goal initially, certainly in the first couple of years, was to figure out, like, is self-sampling acceptable? Is this a feasible method of disease prevention? And if yes, like, how do we think about ensuring that women who need to get screened have access to this screening modality?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think it's it is an important part of the conversation in terms of those early questions, which I think really speaks to kind of how we make those values and the judgments about the studies that we do. So thank you for addressing that. I think the other thing that I'm curious from looking at a question on the side that I'm interested to get your perspectives on, because I think not having a word for the cervix is not the same thing as having misconceptions or myths, right? And so I think the question they're asking specifically is dispelling myths or misconceptions on cervical cancer. And one, I'd like you to distinguish between those two, and if you really thought that there were myths that were preventing folks from thinking about.
So I think what people have as truth is their truth, right? So like if a woman deeply believes that like the speculum is changing the tone or rigidity of her vagina, like I can tell her that it's not. And at the end of the day, I'm likely not changing her mind. So because she's learned that from mothers, grandmothers, aunts, sisters, who she trusts a whole lot more than me. So for me, my goal wasn't to change those misperceptions. My goal was to work within it. So I think when you're trying to change community, in this case, behavioral practices, screening, the goal is how do you get women to screen in a way that they find to be acceptable? And self-sampling circumvented some of these cultural barriers to screening uptake because it did not involve a speculum. And many women, even if they don't regularly use like a tampon, you know, to control menstrual flow, they had at least tried one. And so it was a much more easy way to, like we had a way to educate. I also think that, like, yes, these are myths and misconceptions, but like I don't like to use those words because I think it privileges a type of knowledge. And I think that, like, if you're talking about working with communities, you have to ultimately recognize that, like, you have a knowledge and an academic expertise that, like, actually is matched by their community know-how and expertise. And ultimately, in order to develop new technology and to disseminate it in a way that, like, changes the burden of disease, it requires both of those knowledges to be honored and to be represented. And so I just, you know, I'd be careful because what we say matters. Like, discourse matters. And so when we say things like misconceptions, like, sure, scientifically, you're right. It's inaccurate that the speculum is changing the vagina, but it doesn't appreciate like why women believe that, or the fact that this is a patriarchal culture in which women were often not given the opportunity for secondary education. And so were largely dependent on male partners for their financial security and that of their children.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And that's even more nuanced than I presented it, but that's super helpful. And I think addresses hopefully the question that was raised. And if not, we're happy to continue as a secondary. So in terms of thinking the timing, you said so really successful in terms of getting those grants, thinking about a problem that I think that you're committed to being rigorous about coming up with solutions as well as generating data. And I guess maybe the way that I would kind of posit this, the question here is, I'm thinking about the ethics, I'm thinking about values. How do we encourage folks who are early in their career to be willing to tackle problems in a rigorous way, still be open to be surprised by their data and the accuracies of it? So I'm curious your thoughts on that as our time comes closer to an end.
So I think what I would share, as somebody who's had a lot of different roles in academics over the past 20 years, including running the University of Miami's research enterprise, that what's most important is your purpose. And that's different for everybody. And so when I was running the research enterprise, I very quickly realized that that was not my purpose, that I did not want to be a bureaucrat, that I did not want to spend my day trying to solve for problems for which there weren't resources, and to feel completely disconnected from work that mattered to me. What mattered to me, what matters to me, I guess I should say, is trying to create opportunity in which everybody can benefit from better cancer outcomes. And I say that as somebody who is a cancer survivor and was able to like really call on my medical capital, which is pretty significant, to navigate my diagnosis and treatment in a really expeditious way with lots of support and second opinions, and really came to quickly realize through my own personal journey that like my experience was actually more unique than it should be. That, you know, there were women who had found a lump in their breast and were waiting 6 months to get a diagnostic mammogram. And in that time period, like the nature of their disease had potentially changed, right? In such a way that maybe what would have been pre-invasive disease was invasive, or what was, you know, localized is now metastatic. Oh my God. So I think when you keep your purpose, whatever it is, up close and personal, it ensures that you do what it takes to get the science over the finish line. And like, you have to do it rigorously, because otherwise people will start to question whether your results are a function of like your own personal bias, which we all have, or because of the integrity of the research. And then the last thing I would say is like, you have to be flexible. I started in Little Haiti actually wanting to do work on breast cancer. And very quickly came to realize from my mapping exercise and my conversations with community stakeholders that like my priority wasn't their priority. So I had a choice. I could have like walked away and found another community that wanted to work on breast cancer, or I could have like paused, which is what I did, and said, okay, this incidence rate that I discovered is 4 times higher than anywhere else in the state of Florida. And this is what the community is giving value to. Let me be flexible and see where this goes. I can always pivot. So, you know, I think for me, flexibility, purpose, and making sure that you're doing work, even given its alignment with your personal affinity, meets the criteria for rigor and reproducibility are essential.
Well, that's great. Thank you. I think that's a great place to end the conversation, or at least come to the end. Well, great. Thank you so much for your time. Gracious.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, everyone.
All right. You as well. Bye.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.